We're on. And today's guest, we've got Stephen Smith. First of all, brother, I just want to say thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you very much, mate. Glad to be here.
Listen, I read your book, The Boy in the Cellar. It's a heartbreaking read, very powerful for a boy who was kept in a cellar by his mum and dad for 13 years. Went to a psychiatric, ward as well.
Yeah.
In there for a year, over a year.
Aston Hall.
Yeah, Aston Hall. And then after that, you end up involved with priests. So you were abused from the first 17 years of your life. Was very grim, and the fact that you've wrote this book and telling your story is unbelievable and very powerful, so congratulations.
Thank you.
How have you been?
Great. It's been weird, but it's been an adventure.
Yeah?
Yeah.
A whirlwind.
Yeah. This last year and a half, you wouldn't believe how crazy it's been. But, hey-ho, I've done it, so here we are. I'm sat talking to you now. Yeah. Who'd have thought that?
Lucky bastard. So, I always go back to the start with my guest, Stephen.
Yeah.
How it all began then, when you get kept in a cellar for 13 years, do you remember your first memory?
Not really first memories. I'll tell you what it's like. It's like getting this book, knowing it's about me, but there's great pages missing. And then you remember a bit of it. You remember a page, and then there's like 10 pages missing, and then there's another page, and then there's a couple of pages missing, then there's another page. It's like snippets of memory rather than anything. Up until when I got to about maybe 7 years old, then it starts to get a bit better.
What was your first memory then, at seven?
First memory at seven was when I went to the hospital to have this arm repaired because my dad had broken it. Up until then, there's bits of memories and stuff like from him telling him he was going to release the dog and being beaten up all the time. But you see, I say to you now, being beaten up, but back there to me, it actually seemed normal. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
For you, whatever happened to you when you were a kid was normal. And for everybody else, whatever happens to you when you're a kid, until you start to realise things aren't actually the way they are, you think it's normal. And then all of a sudden this thing clicks into your brain that says, well, actually, this isn't normal.
Uh-huh.
But it takes a long while for you to realise that what is normal to you isn't normal to everybody else.
Yeah. So in the book, your dad broke your arm. I'll not give too much of the book away. But
he broke a lot of, fractured my skull and did all sorts of stuff.
But that was the first time you'd been out the house?
No, I'd been out. When I was one, I'd had tuberculosis and I'd been in hospital for a year, but obviously I don't remember that.
Uh-huh.
When I was two, he'd fractured my skull with a hammer, and I was in hospital with a fractured skull for however long, but obviously I don't remember that. And there's all sorts of other stuff that we've found in my medical records since that I don't remember, even though it says in my records I was in hospital for X amount of time with this bone broken and that bone broken. I don't remember it. So it's not until later on that I remember stuff like in solid lumps.
Yeah, because I think the first time you went to the hospital at seven, the one you can remember, when you started seeing trees and stuff, you were mesmerised.
Yeah, someone told me name.
Yeah, you never knew your name either,
no,
yeah.
Well, he just used to say when he came in, because he used to come down the cellar and he'd bring me books that I had to copy, writing. I had to sit and copy writing stuff out for hours on end, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of times. And he just used to come down and call me. He used to call me the dog.
Yeah.
And he'd lock me in the outside toilet down the yard and stuff and say he was releasing the dog and stuff like that.
Just mental torture as well as physical.
Yeah, yeah.
What was your dad like then? Did anyone ever come over to the house, or was it just you, your mum and dad?
No, I can't even remember my mother. She disappeared when I was about 10 years old and I couldn't tell you what she looked like now.
Did you ever get answers why?
No, one knows, no one understands why. I've had loads of people offer me up all sorts of theories. And some people say it's because he was religious. I don't know. Some people say it was because him and my mother weren't married when I was born. But again, I don't know. I literally don't know because they're long dead.
Uh-huh.
You know, so, and there's no one can make any head and tails out of it. And I've had loads of people, when I was younger, social workers and psychiatrists and doctors, and they all try and come up with reasonable explanations, but at the end of the day, no one knows.
Yeah.
And I'll never know.
Because when you were in hospital as well, Stephen, the doctor asked you what happened and you were so close to telling them what happened, but you changed your story.
Yeah.
Was that with fear?
Yeah, because I knew what had happened to me when he got me back home.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So just beating after beating every day?
Yeah. Every day.
Was there food? Did you have much food?
No, not a lot.
No.
And that's why when it goes on into the book about me escaping from the cellar during the day, when they were at work, I used to sneak out and I found, because it was like a latch on the door, and me being a clever little sod, I'd got a pencil and I could push the pencil through and lift the latch from the other side so the door would open. And I used to sneak out and get into the pantry because they didn't have fridges back then. It was just a pantry with like stone shelves in it and food was kept in there. So I just used to sneak in there and help myself.
Yeah. So when you were 13, eventually people came and got you to take you away from the house. How did they know that you were there? How did they
know? No idea.
No idea.
No one has told me. No one's explained anything. They just turned up one day, two social workers and a copper, and they took me out and they put me in a blue Ford Anglia. And that was it then. I was taken off to a place called Ashley House.
Were you relieved then, thinking I'm free, or did you not quite understand?
No, I think I was in like shock for the first week. Maybe not the first week, the first few days. When I got to Ashley House and I was surrounded by loads of other kids at Ashley House. And it took me a while to get used to that idea that I was in there. And then Milner turned up with another psychiatrist called Ratcliffe. He interviewed me, for want of a better word. Had me sit, because by then I could draw really well, because that's all I got in my cellar was my drawings that I could do. And Milner turned up with a chap called Ratcliffe. And a couple of days, well, a week or so later, I was taken off to be one of Mr. Milner's kids at Aston Hall Mental Hospital. So I went from the fire into the frying pan.
Yeah, and that's, again, you're thinking, am I free? Am I going to get help?
Yeah.
Not realising this place, Aston House, was drugging yous, using the experiment.
Aston Hall was run by a chap called Milner, Kenneth Milner, who at the time, I mean, I didn't know this at the time, I've only found this out many years later. He was used to do a thing called narco-analysis on you, and you were taken upstairs into a little side room. You were fastened, tied up naked on a mattress on the floor. He'd come in, get an injection in the arm, wait a few minutes, then put a mask over your face, and it had like gauze in it, and he'd drip ether onto your face. And basically, it was like you were on a really good acid trip, you know, you were proper stoned. And he'd talk to you, ask you questions, but you didn't know whether you were coming or going. You know, you were absolutely shit-faced, stoned out of your mind. This is what Sergio Amatol does to you. I didn't know that then. And then sometimes I'd wake up and I'd have my knees tied together and my wrists tied together, and I'd be covered in marks all over my legs and my backside, where he'd obviously been belting me, because with my dad, I was an expert on the marks that belts leave, and I could, you know, white line down the middle, red either side, blah, 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 all that shit. So whatever he was doing involved him hitting me while I was unconscious in this stone state. And I was there for a year and 4 months.
And they were drugging the kids there?
Yeah, all of us, yeah.
Using them. Some kids even went missing?
Yeah, loads of kids went missing. There were tales that, obviously, these places, kids tell each other tales when you're new there, especially. Mm. And one of the tales was that Milner had made, because the River Trent flowed through the grounds, and Milner had told these kids, under the influence of his drugs, to go and walk into the river and drown themselves, and they had. And at the time, it was a scary tale, but he didn't know whether it was true or not. And it's only since all this stuff about Milner came to light, and I've seen the records and everything, mm-hmm. that I found out that it was perfectly bloody true.
Yeah. So this Milner ran Aston Hall for 30 years.
Yeah.
So many people came forward as well and told their story, but he would use it as they're psychotic, they're not right in the head, and we'd get away with it.
That's it, yeah.
But he also had connections with Jimmy Savile in Aston Hall.
That's the Well, this I don't know how true all that is, but I've been told that Jimmy Savile was one of the people that had dealings with the place. There were loads of other folk used to turn up. You didn't know who they were. You know, it was much like St. William's later on. Folks turned up in suits, wandered around and boggered off. But in the meantime, Milner got away with doing whatever he wanted to do with whoever he wanted to do it to.
Yeah, kids as young as 12.
12, yeah. Yeah, 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 they were little kids there.
You speak about being friends with a spider.
That's a micella, yeah.
Was that, how did that get you through, do you think, to still being here just now?
Yeah, yeah.
The spider?
Yeah, because all I got in the cellar was me and my imagination. Mm-hmm. And it's the fact that I paint a lot now and all the rest of it. But I've always been, had this artistic thing.
Creative.
And one of the shrinks that I saw a few years back said that it was because I got this really creative mind that I managed to invent a world for me to go into. And the saving grace for everything that happened to me was the fact I've got this, according to the shrinks, I've got a thing called dissociative disorder, which means that no matter what happens to me, I can turn it off. You know, once this thing kicks in, I can shut down any sense of responsibility or anything, just get on and do the thing in front of me and get it out of the way.
So that's to kind of take you away from the reality,
yeah,
the pain and misery you're, yeah, going through, just to take you to a different place and,
yeah,
tell yourself that you're okay, or,
yeah,
things are going to be better.
Yeah.
Honestly, Stephen, your story, even sitting here with the strength you've got, is unbelievable, and I take my hat off to you, brother. It's inspirational, and it may be crazy for people to understand, but for you speaking out is going to help so many other people.
Well, this is the thing, especially blokes, I've found. I want more blokes to come forward, because if they can see someone that's like me coming forward and saying, look, this shit happened to me, and I was only a kid, I couldn't do anything about it, then they can come forward and say, well, I'm the same as you. Mm-hmm. I was only a kid and I couldn't do anything about it.
You speak about one of the wards in Ashton Hall. Is it Elm Ward?
Elm, yeah.
Elm, where the screams and people...
Yeah.
What was that ward like?
It was exactly the same as Beach, the one I was in, except on the outside of it. Imagine a tennis court size area with a tennis court wire mesh fence all the way around it and a tennis court wire mesh roof over the top of it. And out there, there'd be all day long, 24 hours a day, all you could hear from Elm was met, because it was all grown men by then. They were all outside screaming non-stop. They'd be sat there wanking non-stop. Some of them would be there naked, wandering around, some in straight jackets. Some of them fastened into the really big eye back chairs that they used to have, screaming. You know, it was like a vision of bedlam. Mm-hmm. You know, it was as scary as anything you could possibly imagine for young lads to be faced with that. And if you didn't toe the line in Beach, then the staff would say, right, well, carry on misbehaving, you're going to end up in there with them.
Yeah, because one of your stories, you were fighting. Well, somebody was,
yeah,
trying to bully you.
Yeah.
But you've been through that much shit anyway.
Yeah.
Getting hit was nothing.
It just bounced off me.
Yeah. So you cracked up and gave him for what, but you were scared to get put in that.
Yeah.
Elm, is it Elm?
Elm.
Fucking Elm Street, Elm. Nightmare on Elm
That's
Street.
It, yeah.
Yeah. So you were in there just for over 1 year. Did anybody ever come in and...
1 year, 4 months.
Investigate or try and look
social
around?
Social workers had turned up. I think in all the length of time I was there, social workers turned up 3 times to see me, and they'd stay for about half an hour, then fuck off.
Did they ever ask you, is there anything going on?
They'd ask you all sorts about what it was like and if you liked it, and it didn't matter what you told them, because whatever it was you told them, they weren't going to take any notice. They just came, filled out the form, say they'd been, and fucked off.
Do you think they were involved also?
I'm sure they knew what was going on. Mm-hmm.
So that didn't just end from a year there, from being in the cellar for 13 years and then Ashton Hall getting abused. Then you went to, what was the name of
St.
Williams.
St. Williams. St. Williams School Market Week in Yorkshire.
And that was with the priests.
Yeah.
And then they were abusing you and then renting you out as well to paedophile rings.
Yeah.
And you call that from the frying pan to...
Yeah. I started in the fire, went to the frying pan and then back into the fire.
Right into the pit of hell.
Yeah.
That is the pit of hell.
Yeah.
Again, mate, for you to still be here and tell your stories, I'm I'm speechless.
No, there's loads of lads that weren't, because as the lawyers have told me, Mrs. They used to come round to our boat to take statements and stuff, well, back at the house then before we built the boat. And they'd tell us tales of lads that were in St. William's, that were in some of the worst prisons in England, and still are. Some of them had become murderers. Some of them they couldn't find. They don't know what they died, gone off somewhere and died and never been found yet. And there's all sorts of shit happened from the St. William's days.
And that priest, he's still alive? He's in prison just now?
He's in prison. He's doing arse end of 30 years for what he did.
Close to, I think, over 100 people came forward.
There's hundreds of us came forward.
So what was the experience like in there? How old were you then?
When I went there?
Yeah.
I was a little over 14, 14 and a half.
And this was priests?
Yeah.
Were they abusing everybody there?
No, they didn't. As far as I know, they didn't. But there was loads that they did. You know, there were folks would turn up and they'd choose you. You'd be playing because of like a quad in the middle of the place with an archway that got onto the yard, all the buildings all the way around it. You know, imagine a really old Victorian, like public school, basically, big arch that you went under to get to it. Folks would turn up in the big posh cars. Kids would be playing football and Carragher and his mates would be sitting there and they'd be choosing. Oh, I like that one. I like that one. And that was that. And then sometimes they'd get you at St. William's itself and have you there. Or other times they had a cottage on the North Yorkshire Moors in the middle of nowhere and they'd take you up there. But the cottage on the Yorkshire Moors was next to some cliffs, real steep ones. And the tale was there that if you didn't do as you were told, you got chucked off the cliffs. And again, there was a story to back it up that Carragher told everybody. Oh, so-and-so, I threw him off the cliffs and he died. And there are other stories back at St. William's. There's a thing there called the departments. Engineering department, painting department, building department and farm. The builders department had a big garage, big door garage, and it was full of sand. You know, they fill it full of sand. And the tale was that a couple of kids had gone in there and dug themselves like a cave into the sand and it had collapsed on them and killed them both. Carragher's tale was that he used to tell everybody was, I buried them in that sand and you can join them. See, and kids being kids at these places, the tale got passed on to each generation as new kids came into the place.
To drill fear into the kids, to get them to do what they want, just basically grooming them from the get-go.
Yeah.
Did the drug use in there, St. William's?
No, there was no use. It was just violence in St. William's.
Yeah. So after all that then, how did you manage to break free from St. William's?
Because one day, a social worker turned up and said, we're sorry to tell you, Steve, your dad's dead. Right, yeah. What do you want me to do about that? I didn't, you know, if he'd have been there, I would have killed him anyway. Because by that time, I was a big, tough bloke and
filled with hate.
I wasn't scared of him at all anymore. Seemed far worse than him. But he died. And then a couple of days later, he turned up again, got me bag of stuff, and very important, me records and stuff, and me music that was really important to me at that point. Because up until being in St. William, Aston Hall, I'd never heard music. But one of the nurses there bought me a record player, and he bought me three records with it. One was Hawkwind Road Hawks, which is part of the band that I'm in now. We're all ex-members of Hawkwind. Then he bought me Black Sabbath Volume 4.
Oh, is he?
Yeah. and he bought me an album called Suck It and See and an album called Gun Race with the Devil. And they were the ones that set me off on me love of music, because up until then I'd never heard music. Luckily, the bloke liked proper music and not... Otherwise, I could have been into bloody ABBA and all sorts, in which case I wouldn't have been sat here talking to you. But luckily, the man was into proper music, so there we go. Anyway, I packed my records up, packed my record player up that I'd still got from Mr. Bradbury Geen at me back at Aston Hall. They took me back to where I was from, back then, Enor it was. And they got me a flat at the back of a pet shop, which was the scariest place ever. Mm-hmm. If you ever slept behind it, had a flat in a pet shop back in the 70s, Because back in the 70s, you could keep every animal known to man. And the pet shops, were all you could hear all night were parrots squeaking and animals squawking and dogs barking and shit like that. It was like being at Haunted Ayres.
You slept in Elm Street with fucking people screaming and getting thoughts about the noises of dogs and animals just freaked out.
To things scampering around and squealing all night. Yeah, I tell you.
So obviously your trust issues and everything must have been shot to fuck to get to then and then having your freedom. How was your mindset then? Did you ever feel like quitting or giving up, or did you feel?
I never felt like giving up. Never ever entered my mind. They got me in the flat. The social workers had got me a job at a place called Smith's Flour Mill at Langley Mill, which was a great big flour mill. And I spent about 2 years there humping around great big sacks of flour. Started drinking, started with drugs, and I spent 10 years being not a very nice person. And then I thought, I can't keep doing this. My son was born, so I stopped doing it, and I decided I got to change and be a nice person rather than be an angry person, because I'd been angry for like 10 years. I was as angry as fuck, and all I did was drink, fight, fuck.
Yeah. And, just to mask.
And stuff, you know.
But I think anybody would give you a free pass for that, Stephen, because what you went through, there's no words to describe what you went through. So you're going to be angry, you're going to be hating the world and why me?
Oh, yeah.
But
not
realising that some people need to go to the darkest places to eventually find the light. And then now you've got the light. You can help guide others out of darkness.
Well, that's the whole reason of doing all this
Yeah,
stuff.
Kind of, and it's... Yeah.
If other blokes look at me and think, well, if he can come forward, then everybody else can.
Yeah. Do you ever speak to anybody from back in the day, Aston House or St Williams, Aston Hall? No?
No. No. I've had a couple... Since I did the book, I've had a couple of messages off some lads from St Williams saying that they don't want to come forward, but thanks for bringing it out and keeping the fight going.
Yeah.
And we've now got a lawyer back on the case who's willing to take all these St Williams cases back on.
Because it was an independent report in 2018 found nearly 100 kids were drug stripped and abused. And that was only
that's just 2 years ago. Scratching the surface,
So it just shows you how long that's been open for how long? 60 years, 70 years?
What? Yeah. Yeah, Aston Hall was there for many, many, many years, and Milner ran it. Not only that, he worked at other psychiatric hospitals as well, and there are other psychiatrists doing just as bad tests and things on kids at other hospitals. But Milner used to say to us that we were mental deficients, weren't it? Mental defectives, and therefore we were his property and at his disposal, was his argument.
Cheeky bastard.
And he was testing these drugs now because they wanted to find the perfect true serum. That's what he was looking for. Sodium amytal was the one, an ether. And that's what Milner was looking for. He dedicated his entire life to using different drugs on kids. You know, I mean, I've read reports that say that he used LSD on us as well and stuff like that. Well, having taken LSD, I can well believe it, because it reminds you being back then. So I know exactly, I can compare the two things together and know exactly what it was he was doing.
So was he just drugging kids to abuse them, or was he actually, what was he searching for anything?
No, it was proper researching into looking for a true serum for the government and people. And when you speak to Barbara later on, she's going to bring you some paperwork. I've seen the paperwork that she's got. And Barbara's like tenacious as a mad rat. You know, she'll not let anything lie. And she's dug up all this stuff. And it shows the connection between Milner, the American CIA, a thing called MKUltra, and all these other secret government department stuff, where he was testing drugs and sending them reports. So they got the perfect truth serum to use on enemy combatants, was the term.
Yeah. So they're picking innocent kids, people who are vulnerable, people who are causing trouble or kept in the cellar, and people think, oh, they're crazy. So if they do run away or speak out,
nobody's going to believe them.
Well,
the social workers, the police, Everybody used to tell them, till you were blue in the face, and not one of them gave a shit.
Yeah.
You know, you could tell they knew, and I swear to God, they all knew, but they didn't care. Because
mm-hmm.
whatever our authority or power over them had told them that certain people at certain places, you don't take any notice of them.
When did you start opening up about this? When did you start saying I need to speak to someone or just speak out? Because a lot of people bottle all this up and blame themselves.
Probably about 15, 20 years ago.
Yeah?
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, I had to tell my wife, Gail, because I have nightmares, real, real bad nightmares. I wake up screaming and she's had to chase me up the street naked while I'm asleep, trying to get me back into the house. And she's had to stop me smashing windows and climbing out of bedrooms and pulling the furniture apart, and you're in all sorts.
Fair play for standing by and being honest.
But I had to, because my first wife, Lorraine, I'd never told, she knew I had nightmares, obviously, but I never told her why. And we weren't together very long in the end anyway. So later on, I thought, well, I'm going to have to tell her, because it must be driving her mad every night, me waking up screaming and smashing off stuff and what have you. And I'd got, even after we got together, I've got no tolerance for people talking down to me. I've got no tolerance for people in authority. But if anyone does anything that really pisses me off, then again, I've got no sense of what I shouldn't do to them. I mean, one night we were in a pub and this bloke had a pop at me for something, didn't he? And I picked him up and threw him over a pool table. Got him by arse of his jeans, and as he went, the arse of his jeans ripped right the way down, and he shot out of his jeans like a fucking cannon. And the following day, he came up to me in here, and he got a letter, and he signed it, and it was a bill for his new jeans.
Some people would pay fortunes for ripped jeans now. So that must have been to open up to Gail. Then you must have knew, right? Okay, if I can open up to her, then there's a trust.
Yeah,
the trust is there. To not open up to anyone, then it's trust issues, isn't it? So,
yeah.
And obviously, it must have been difficult for Gail, because she must have been thinking, he's a fucking nutcase.
Oh, she was.
He is a nutcase, but. Yeah.
So, and then I went off and I thought, well, I'm going to. And at the time, I got a particularly good doctor. And I told him some of it. And he got me in to see this shrink woman. Who, I mean, I'm dead weary of shrinks anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, the first time I had to go and see this Godsey fella, who's like one of the top shrinks in the country, does mass murderers and folks. I had to go and see him. And he came out and shook her hand and told, what does he say to you? I'm a remarkable man.
And you should be dead.
And I should have been dead years ago, and he doesn't understand why I'm still alive.
Mm-hmm. I don't know, is that compliment or an insult?
Yeah, that's what I thought. But he explained to her, and the other shrinks, I always make them explain to her what's wrong with me. Because I don't take it seriously. I mean, my first words to Godsey were, look, I've got to come and talk to you because the lawyers have told me. I says, but I want to tell you now that I won't trust you because a mad psychiatrist once experimented on me and tried to kill me. Mm-hmm. And then I had to explain to him. And then he knew all about Aston Hall anyway. Because it's like required learning now among shrinks of what Milner was doing to us.
Yeah. It's scary that those people in high powers can get away with such violent and dirty crimes that...
Yeah.
And the scary thing is it's happening now
Somewhere around there, it's happening right now. Mm-hmm. Right now in England. In more than one place, I would imagine.
Yeah. Because it's a lot more people are speaking out about it because the mainstream media haven't really got as much power as they did to brainwash people and feed people what they wanted.
Yeah.
A lot of people now have the freedom of speaking out and bringing hope and inspiration to other people like yourself.
Yeah.
So that 10-year period, Stephen, when you were free and you were out and you were angry and full of drugs and drink, you says when your first son was born is what changed your mindset and going, wait a minute,
yeah.
I've got a life here.
I thought, can't keep doing what I'm doing, otherwise I'm never going to get to see my kids grow up. And that's what I did. I just said, I've done with it all, done. And I concentrated then on my painting, my music, and all the other stuff I used to do, you know, work and all the rest of it. And I had to stop and look after my kids.
Because obviously the stuff that you went through, you'd have had to realise, okay, if I'm not there for my son, potentially that could happen also.
Yeah.
Do you sell your art or anything? Can we put links for people to look at it or buy it?
The best place to find it is to go on my Facebook page.
Okay, what's the name of your Facebook page?
It's just Stephen Smith. And you'll see there's a photo of me and her on it, so you can't miss
Gail,
it.
Yeah.
And I just, because I've got this one rule about my art I've stuck to all my life, much to her annoyance. No matter what I paint, or I do book covers, video sleeves, you name it, I've painted thousands of bloody things. Everything that moves, I've painted it. I never, ever charge more than, say it's taking me a day to do a painting, right? Then for that painting, I'll charge 40 quid. And I never change that. And I've had art galleries after me. Art galleries hate me. They send me loads of requests, don't they? Why don't you put some of your paintings in our gallery? And I say, well, why? Because we can sell them for you. So, well, it's not a gallery then, is it? It's a shop. Call it a gallery if you want, but if you've got a price ticket on it, then it's a shop. So I refuse to have anything to do with people that do that. Yeah. I'd sooner sell a painting for a few quid, knowing that it's going to hang on someone's wall because they love it and they want it, than ever put one in an art gallery. And that's what I do.
Do you think the painting saved your life?
Oh, yeah. Painting and music, definitely.
Therapy for you.
Yeah.
Do you remember the first time you started drawing or painting?
Always.
Yeah.
That's what I did in my cellar. Mm-hmm. That's all I could do.
Yeah. Just art. Just kept you going and just visualising that you were outside.
Yeah.
Just believing that one day you would be out.
Yeah. Well, I mean, a lot of the stuff that was outside, I didn't know existed. Because it's hard to draw a tree if you don't know what a tree is. Because you don't know the name of it. You don't even know it's green. I mean, it's just a thing. Mm-hmm. And it's not, when you learn stuff as you get older and realise that is a thing. But for me, it took a lot longer to learn that a thing was that thing.
Yeah.
Because I didn't know the name of it, and I didn't know what it was.
How did you learn how to read and write?
My dad taught me.
So he taught you that as well?
Oh, he used to turn up with books. You know, like old school writing books that you see? He'd come down, he'd have written like a page on one side, and I'd have to copy it like dozens and dozens of times and be able to read it and rewrite it and what have you. And if I got it wrong, then I get a good hiding. And it was same with maths and whatever the subject
was. Just everything, just getting a hiding for certain things. So how do you... Is there anything now in life that triggers you and brings back a lot of emotion, memory for you that you can maybe put you in a downer or a certain noises?
There's certain smells I can't have near me. You know Fisherman's Friends?
Yeah.
Can't have them anywhere near me because they taste and smell exactly like the ether that Milner used to put on your face. Mm-hmm. They remind me of that no end. Can't be doing with anybody giving me orders or ordering me about or talking down to me or anything like that. I just that completely is a no, no. Yeah. And what else have I got that annoys me, that sets me off?
I think we should get you a seat for this one, Gail.
Cooking. Oh, yeah. I can't have anything near my face. That's why I've always had a beard. Can't have anything on my face.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, because once at the hospital, I had an asthma attack once and I was in the hospital, weren't I? And it took 10 nurses and doctors and her and my daughter screaming at the side of me to hold me down while I was throwing them all around. And it was only because he wants to put a mask on my face.
Obviously, but that's natural, though, that you wouldn't want that shit happening.
We've got a thing now at the hospital on my medical records that says that they've got to, and I always get my own room now, don't I? And I get taken straight to my own room and she's allowed to stay with me. And nurses only come in if there's two of them and, you know, stuff like that. But, you know, it's just nothing I can do about it. It's just in there.
How was it, like, speaking about it, how was it writing a book? Did it bring back a lot of emotion for you, a lot of misery and pain, or did it make you feel good to get it off your chest?
It made me good to feel get it off my chest, but it made me, for a while I felt really angry that two-thirds of the folks in there are dead. Because I'd still, you know what I mean, put me in a room with Carrigan and I'd still like to throttle him, even though he is 80, 8 years old or whatever the hell he is now.
But for him to, because he got sentenced, I was reading it over the last few days, he already did like 14 years, and then
the coppers find some more cases and they take him back to court and he gets found guilty, gets sent back to prison. Mm. But there's loads of us. I mean, I've never, ever, ever had a copper come up to me and ask me to write a statement about what happened to me at St William's. And there's loads of us that haven't. The only statements I've ever written have been for the lawyers.
Mm-hmm.
And he's never been tried for what he did to me. Or loads of other lads, they just took a few cases. Each time he's ready to come out, they have another Crown Court day and he goes in there and then they put him back in prison.
So he's going to rot in hell, basically.
Well,
going to rot in there because if he ever does get out, then there's more cases still there.
Yeah.
But that's a good idea not to try them all at once, because then it would only be one sentence.
Yeah.
So, but in his 80s anyway, so he deserves everything he fucking gets.
Oh, yeah, his horse is never coming out there.
So the book, again, when you're writing that, that's the most vulnerable you could possibly be, is bearing everything onto something that you know everybody else is going to read.
No, it's I've not allowed my sons to read it ever. My three sons and my daughter, they wanted to read it.
Mm-hmm.
And my youngest son, New Year's Eve, we were in the pub, weren't we? Because all my family, we all go out together. Me and my sons, you know, we really are proper close family.
Good.
And we're out New Year's Eve. And our Jakey, my youngest, he was crying. And he'd only read like the first half dozen pages, hadn't he? And I had to put my foot down and say, look, I know you know what's in there, but there's nothing good going to come out of them reading about what happened to the dad. I mean, middle lad, he just gets angry and he wants to go finding him. But like I said to him, they're all old men or they're dead now. So there's nothing you can do about it.
Mm-hmm.
So that took a lot of me thinking about, because I knew what effect it would have on me kids.
Yeah.
And I know what my mates are like, because those my mates, they didn't know about any of this.
Yeah.
They knew some of it, some of them did, but not all of them. And I was sort of worried what their reaction was going to be.
Yeah.
About all this stuff that happened to me.
It's a fucking brave thing to do, Stephen.
But so far, I haven't had one negative comment off anybody ever. Not one.
And rightly so,
it's all been really good.
And rightly so.
Which is sort of surprising, really.
Yeah. How did Gail deal with it when you first spoke to her about it?
She just got used to the idea, didn't you?
There's nothing you can do, though, is there?
Well, because she
did
was
it
always...
Did it make sense, though, that the madness came from?
Once everything sort of became... Because it's such a fantastic story that it was almost like, yeah, all right, then.
Mm-hmm.
It's just him.
Yeah.
Once she'd spoken to the shrinks, you see, and because I always made a point of her talking to the shrinks... Mm-hmm. Because I ain't got a lot of trouble with what shrinks tell you, you know. It's all, oh, I'm being very mindful about this and very mindful about that. And, you know, whilst tapping you on the back of the hand with a pen, because tapping you on the back of the hand with a pen is going to fucking cure you. You know, it's half of what shrinks tell you is bullshit. The best people for folks like me to talk to are folks like me, fuckers that have been there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all this psychiatric bollocks, mumbo jumbo, it's crap. Let them come down, talk to me, go on the piss with me for a night, have a laugh, and then listen to me tell them what they should be doing with their lives and how you don't have to be a fucking slave to what people did to you when you were a kid. When you were a kid, you've got no responsibility. You can't stop what's going to happen to you. You've got no say in it. You know that they're going to rag you out, they're going to fuck you, they're going to do whatever they fucking want to you. Fucking decide, make a decision. Say it, I'm not going to go down that road that I went down with them fuckers. I'm going to stand up for myself.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what blokes like me, you need to come forward and fucking say it.
Yeah, I think a lot of people, though, they're scared, because like we spoke earlier, I think a lot of people, and it's scary to think that they blame themselves, they question was I on the right, was I on the wrong? Yeah. So for anybody that's gone maybe through this, listen to Stephen's story, read his book, and you can find the inspiration to come forward and expose people.
Whatever happened to you when you're young, you've got no fucking choice in it. You know, no, there's nothing you can do short of killing yourself, which is just means they've won. And it's like, if I was in any way, balmy now or screwed up by what they did to me, then Carragher, sat in his cell, has got another victory over me. Even from all them years ago, he's got yet another victory, and I'm not going to give him that. and Milner in hell or wherever he is looking down, if I let it think that he's affected me for all my life and screwed me up, then he's got another victory. And I'm not, they had their victories up until I was 17. Mm-hmm. No more.
Your band, you're in a successful band, you travel all over.
I do.
With the music, like you spoke earlier, yeah. it's potentially saved your life as well as yeah. the art. Yeah. How did your band come about?
Oh, I've always had a love of music and stuff, right from Aston Hall when I got given these records. And I thought, one day I'm going to be in Orkwin. That was my favourite band. I've known Orkwin all my life, obviously, well, since then. And there, I've played with pretty much every ex-member at Orkwin. And in my band now, there's Dead Fred, who was in Orkwin for years, and those other folks come and guest with us who were in Orkwin for years. So I've done that dream that I had back then. I've done it.
It's amazing that you have done it, to grow the confidence as well, to be standing on stages and singing in front of people, because there's people who have been brought up in a great life who shit themselves to go on stage.
Oh, I've seen some really famous people backstage throwing up, haven't we? And like that, gibbering wrecks. I just march straight on and get on with it. I don't get a wang. I once, at a festival, it was getting boring once, and famous. It's the first time and only time I've ever done this. There was a woman, big woman she was, Scottish, strangely enough, and she's got a wagon full of women's clothes. So I went and got dressed as a woman. I've got shitloads of photos. I've put a tutu on, a basque, dustbin bags down, and it still got my other hat on and these great big boots, and none of the band knew I was going to do it. And there was a door led you onto the stage, and there's all these people all waiting there, and I was only going on to do two songs with them. The rest of the band are playing away, and it was, we were doing I Just Want to Be Your Dog by the Stooges. Mm-hmm. I marched onto the stage dressed as this woman, got the microphone and started singing. The rest of the band shit themselves, didn't know what they were doing. And the audience went absolutely wild, didn't they? Mm-hmm. And to this day, I still get messages every time we go and play a new festival, people say, are you going to do your woman thing? Because I made such an attractive woman. I think it was the beard that did it. Yeah. So no, I've got no.
Yeah, no fear.
Yeah. It's almost impossible to embarrass me. You know.
Mm-hmm. Which is a powerful thing then, because you've used everything to your advantage.
Oh yeah.
Which is a tough thing to do. Yeah. Yeah. So going forward for the future with you, Stephen, everything you went through. Listen, you're a great guy, man. You're funny. Clearly a fucking nutcase, but yeah, I'm going to be
absolute
honest. You know what I mean?
Stark staring mad, but there you go.
For everything you've went through into releasing the book, what other things you got in the pipeline, Stephen?
I've got, well, as it happens, while I'm in here talking to you right now, the rest of my band are in the recording studio recording our new CD album for this year. I'm supposed to be there singing it on the grounds I wrote the songs. But I've had to come here and do this with you. So now they've had to book an extra fucking day in the recording studio for £300
a day. I'll make sure I promote all your songs. Where can people get your music or watch your music?
We've got our own Facebook page, Captain Starfighter and the Lockheeds.
Uh-huh.
And yeah, you can find us on there, easy peasy. Uh-huh. But we play all over the place, one festival after another and stuff.
You enjoying it then, your passion?
Oh, it's brilliant, I love it. Yeah.
Any talks of maybe turning this into a film?
Supposedly there's some guy from foreign parts, America, that's a...
No, she's saying nothing. She's saying nothing.
What is he? Screenwriter. Yeah. Uh-huh. He's taking an interest in it. But I don't know how all that works. So I don't get involved. That's her department over there.
It's weird though, because the boy in the cellar, I'm reading that. I don't know why, but I think of America when I read this. It's like, you don't really hear this in the UK. You think,
well, one of
America.
The questions someone asked me, they were on about someone in Belgium or Germany or somewhere.
Fritzo?
Yeah, that kept members of his family in the cellar.
I think
years.
There was a few of them, yeah. I've never read anything like this from the UK. So, it's been eventful, brother. You're a great guy, and it's been an honour to sit here and share your story with me, because I know you're a busy man now. Just to finish up, if you get any advice for anybody who's maybe going through the struggle yourself, maybe getting abused and are confused, any advice you would have for them?
Tell people about it. Tell the people you love about it and don't hide it. Come out and stand there and say, fuck you lot, you're not screwing me up forever. That's the thing people need to do.
Yeah. Brilliant, Stephen. Listen, you're an inspiration. It's been an honour to meet you, brother. Yeah, thank you, and God bless. We'll put all the links in the description for the book, Stephen's music, Facebook pages. So get involved, man, and get the book, definitely, because it's a powerful read. So thank you again, brother.
Cheers. Thank
you. You can also watch my podcast on my YouTube channel. The link is in the bio if you'd like to subscribe. You can follow me on my social media platforms to see who my next guest is. Follow me on Facebook at JamesEnglish11, Twitter, JamesEnglish0, Instagram, JamesEnglish2. You can also download these podcasts on iTunes or Spotify.